I'm very happy to welcome now Ageth Slaus. She's professor of history at Butler University, and she has spent this past academic year at the School for Advanced Research. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me, Mary Charlotte.
So you have been writing about the, shall we call him an the anthropologist Carlos Castaneda, but was he really an anthropologist?
Well, this is, yeah, where it gets interesting, right? Because he's no longer remembered as an anthropologist, but that's how he started. He actually, when he wrote his first book, and the first book was published by the University of California Press, The Teachings of Don Juan, which came out in 68, he had been an anthropology, a graduate student at UCLA in the anthropology department. The book actually earned him a master's degree. The book became insanely popular. I really don't think that he or the press knew that it would be sort of a runaway cult hit at the time. But it was also picked up by anthropology professors. It was assigned to classes. And so by the time he writes his third book, he's still a PhD student, and he is basically awarded his doctoral degree on that third book, The Journey to Ixtlán, even though if you look in the files at UCLA, the dissertation has a different name, but it's pretty much the same text as far as I can tell. And other people have asserted that as well. But so he was considered for quite a while a bona fide anthropologist, and I think he might have even taught some classes at UCLA. And it wasn't until, I think it was 74, that there was an article in Time magazine that had brought up that the writer, Joyce Carol Oates, had approached the New York Times book review section saying, "I can't believe that you refute his last book, Journey to Ixtlán, as anthropology, as nonfiction. I am a writer of fiction, and this is this beautiful fiction, but it's fiction." So she was the one who sort of put the controversy much more in the public spotlight, and then Time picked it up. And then, you know, it was a controversy for a while, but anthropologists didn't really seem to do very much with the controversy. You know, they were very much quiet about it for a long time.
So the question, I mean, was it ever resolved whether his writings about this Yaqui shaman and his experiences and his kind of journey to other worlds of the mind or whatever, was that true? Did he make it up? Do we know?
Well, I think for a lot of people that It's interesting, this idea of truth and authenticity, right? And it's very important, obviously, in anthropology. If you say that you wrote this ethnography about this person, and this person is representative, and at first he seemed to be representative of very particular people, the Yaqui, you know, of southern Arizona, northern Mexico, one would think that it's very important to be able to show that this did not have elements of fiction at all. And I think that what happened was that there were a number of detractors, and this most important one was somebody by the name of Richard DeMille, the son of Cecil B. DeMille, the director.
Right.
And he was an academic himself, but he was not in anthropology. He was in psychology, and he wrote two pretty formative books. And he was really, he almost sort of started a crusade among anthropologists to sort of garner support that Castaneda was a fraud and should be discredited and so forth. And so what I found that in 78 at the annual Anthropological Association meeting, which was in Los Angeles at that time, there were two panels on Castaneda, and one of them was organized by Richard DeMille. And you know, there were particular people who said, yeah, this is not true, it should be discredited. But ultimately, the American Anthropological Association, the AAA, didn't really do very much about it. It's not like, for instance, what happened with, I don't know if you've ever heard about this, but the Rigoberto Menchú controversy,
yeah.
Or even more recently, Napoleon Chagnon. A number of books were written about Castaneda, discrediting him and also shedding light on how this could have happened within U.S. anthropology and U.S. academic climate, but it was sort of left alone.
Yeah, and meanwhile, there are a number of other very interesting questions, namely, okay, here's an anthropologist and School for Advanced Research is full of anthropologists and everybody's writing books and everybody's studying something, but very few have runaway bestsellers with multiple sequels that influence entire generations of people. And
absolutely.
Who was reading Castaneda's work and who did it influence? I mean, what did that whole picture look like? Because that went way outside the circles of anthropologists.
Well, and I think maybe because of that, you know, and this is just venturing guesses because I don't have any concrete evidence for this yet, and maybe I never will, but because it became part of the New Age movement, and Castaneda is sometimes even called the grandfather of the New Age. Now, whether or not that is true or people agree with that, I don't know, but he was extremely formative in that particular movement. So the teaching in and of itself eclipsed whether or not, I think, of this question of whether was he an anthropologist or not. You know, it seemed it didn't matter to people anymore. And you're right, he was hugely influential. He was translated into 22 languages. None of the books ever went out of print, so they're still being read.
To this day.
To this day, yeah. The first three books still sell the best of all of them, but you're right, it was an entire series of almost, you know, 12 books in total. And it was very, very influential, I think, for people. And also people, I think, that were very deeply interested in shamanism as well, you know, who were anthropologists themselves or, you know, were students. And this really became very influential for them. To do their own studies about shamanism. But yeah, so there were so many people. I mean, I've talked to people who, of a number of different age groups. It was primarily the 60s generation at first. But I think after that, there are just all kinds of people from all walks of life. Even among, you know, the early politically in the Chicano community as well. You know, there were a number of people that sort of used him or used his books as a way to find spiritual ties to Mexico and to Aztlan.
Now, what about indigenous people, indigenous groups, when they came in contact, as everybody else in the world did at that time and ongoing, to Castaneda's work? Did it affect the way they saw themselves and their cultures? And I realize the group indigenous is a very big group, but America, you know, people in the United States, people in Mexico, and so on.
Yeah, and I'm this is what I'm really interested in as well, because in Mexico, well, certainly in the United States, there's the American Indian movement, and it's very highly political. But in Mexico as well, there were indigenous congresses. I mean, this was usually, I mean, an effort that came from either anthropologist and or the state in Mexico, but there was an effort to basically reach indigenous people who was felt the revolution, and in Mexico the revolution was still ongoing at this time for some people that the revolution had left behind. So there's a lot of organization going on in terms of the state level, but also federal level in Mexico. And in 1974, there's the first national indigenous Congress under, you know, that's propagated by the president, Luis Echeverria at the time. But what indigenous people did with it themselves, I'm still working on, because, you know, there's different groups. And they're definitely people. I mean, at first we know that the Yaqui were impacted by counterculture tourists who came looking for Don Juan.
Right. Did Don Juan exist?
Well, my guess is probably not. Although some people have the idea that maybe Don Juan was a composite of a number of different shamans, including female shamans. And this is also where the gender aspect comes in. But yeah, of different shamans. And that Castaneda had at least spoken with, because a lot of the circle that he studied with were students who were very interested in shamanism. Barbara Meyerhoff, Peter First, who had very deep studies into the Huichol community, but not the Yaqui community. Yaquis were, I mean, there are reports that they at times were sort of overrun by these counterculture tourists, you know, that came from the United States primarily, but also from Europe and from Mexico themselves. And And that people sort of moved on to the Huichol lands, you know, because that's where peyote was used ritually, is used ritually, whereas that's not the case in the Yaqui community. What these people themselves took away from that, I think there were definitely some who found this amusing, maybe, some who found it annoying, some who were definitely not happy about this happening. But I think that there were also some alliances that were made as well. And I think in the long run, what happens not only with Castaneda, but this kind of sort of popular anthropology about indigenous people does lend them an air that in some ways is depoliticizing and essentializing as well.
What does that mean, essentializing?
Well, just, you know, basically saying that as Indians, they are in a particular way. And of course, what comes across in Castaneda's work is there's really one main figure. I mean, it's not an ethnography of a community, but this one main figure, Don Juan primarily, but who is, you know, this extremely wise, stoic, humble Indian, but who has a knowledge that Western people just do not possess at all.
Which and seems like that was the appeal of the whole thing.
Right.
This knowledge that Western people don't possess and that they're hungry for.
Right, exactly. But it's also a particular, it feeds into a much larger kind of historical trajectories of romanticization of indigenous people, right? Which starts with the noble savage, with Montaigne and, you know, the 16th, 17th century and so forth. But at the same time, indigenous people can also sort of use that kind of romanticization and essentialization in a way that is politically advantageous to them. So by the time that you get the first indigenous congresses, but specifically after, I think that some indigenous groups anyway, but that, yes, even when in particular indigenous groups, say, you know, for instance, you know, the Mai or Zapotec or whatever, there are many, many umbrella, many, many different kinds of tensions depending on these people's positions in, you know, their community and their family and so forth. But this particular idea was useful for them in some ways to actually bargain vis-a-vis the national government in Mexico. And
so they had a position of power where they were seen not as the bottom of the totem pole, but as these keepers of tremendous knowledge and culture and so on, and that gave them bargaining chips, essentially, politically.
Yeah, I think so. There is this idea that in Mexican anthropology, very early on, it's about rescatar la cultura, to rescue the culture. And so, but specifically under Echeverria, I mean, this idea that the countryside, instead of just being merely made up of maybe indigenous mestizo campesinos, because it was very much seen as a class identity, now becomes an ethnic identity again, now becomes an indigenous identity again. So in that sense, these things feed into one another.
We're talking to Ahez Laus about Carlos Castaneda. Do you ever have the phenomenon, or have you seen in your work the phenomenon of indigenous people taking work like Carlos Castaneda, and then, I mean, you have Americans romanticizing them, but what about them romanticizing themselves?
I have to be honest and say that you know, the research hasn't, I mean, this is a missing piece in the research at this point in time, and I can't really say with any kind of overall, you know, conclusive evidence. I do think that you can see it happening to a certain extent, but also, again, to great advantage politically in the Zapatista community, where, you know, with the Zapatista uprising with, at that time, called Neo-Zapatistas, because, you know, it was harkening back to the Mexican Revolution, but in 1994, when they rose up, and they basically said, yeah, basta, it's enough. And they actually, for the first time, I think, inserted a platform of indigenous rights within a larger human rights platform, at least in Mexico. And I think some of these things, like not only having been conquered for 500 years, that colonialism is ongoing, you know, that it didn't stop with the Mexican state becoming the Mexican state and so forth, that the revolution never really addressed these kinds of issues, but also that they are the keepers, as you said, of a particular culture, And that these traditions need to be taken seriously, but at the same time also having, you know, very apt women rights that they inserted into these agendas as well. It's like it sort of speaks to a really savvy understanding of themselves, but also of how they are perceived in the rest of the world, right? And what would be politically advantageous. And they did that very well.
Very interesting. Now, when you read Carlos Castaneda, you're reading it as a historian, an anthropologist, as an academic. Do you ever read it just as a regular person, putting yourself in the shoes of the spiritual seeker of the 1960s and 70s?
Well, yeah, and I have to be, you know, completely frank that the first time I read Castaneda, I mean, I'm not quite old enough to be of that generation, but I did read it as being introduced by other people who, you know, thought this was super, super interesting. And I was in the Netherlands, you know, 16 years old, and this is how I was introduced, you know, to Carlos Castaneda. So for me, it was very much about the ideas, and this was fascinating. And I think to a certain extent, I was also one of these people who was already interested in going to Mexico, but this really helped sort of fortify that feeling. Like, well, now I this sounds really like a fascinating place, and I want to go there.
And did you want to, like, have otherworldly experiences of your own?
Yeah, but I don't think I went as far as some people. I was probably not, you know, not as progressive and not as daring as some people. But I was very interested by that. And so I think from a personal perspective, really understand what was so fascinating about him and what remains fascinating about him today. It's like he offered not only a different world, but I think he offered people a way out of, you know, a very sort of traditional bourgeois kind of spirituality as well, right? I mean, this was one way to connect with alternative spiritualities for very many people that were looking for that, and, you know, in a society that seemed more and more devoid of being fulfilling in that way.
Right. Now, is his work still influential today, do you think, or is the moment kind of past?
I think it's interesting in that what I see, it's sort of, you know, that there's sort of these peaks and these ups and downs. And in the beginning, the late 60s and 70s, he was extremely popular, and he was still not in hiding too. So even though he was always very, very careful, he wasn't photographed very much. He did like maybe one or two radio interviews. That's it. But he was sort of still seen too, and so he had this kind of rock star status almost. And after that, I think there's sort of a lull. But you know, I think people were still reading him, and I think they're reading him today. And as a matter of fact, what is very interesting is that when he sort of came out of hiding in the 1990s, he had set up a corporation, a Clear Green Corporation. The headquarters are in Los Angeles. And these people do shamanic workshops. They do, and it's based on sort of where the latest kind of form of his teachings was called tensegrity. And the last few books are about tensegrity. And it's sort of, you know, also with physical movements and how you do this to reach, you know, a more spiritual awareness. And some of these workshops are still very, very popular, even in Mexico City. You know, and a lot of women actually go to these workshops. And so I think a lot of people are still reading him. People are still interested in this. And I think this corporation and how they organize these workshops and how many people come to these workshops is sort of evidence of that as well.
We're talking to Ajeith Slaus about Carlos Castaneda. So you've been at the School for Advanced Research this whole year and are just leaving Santa Fe. What have you learned? Like, have you come to a new understanding or new conclusions about Carlos Castaneda and his influence?
Yeah, I mean, being at SAR has been just life-changing. I mean, I'm extremely grateful that I had the opportunity to be there, and I'm sure for most academics, not having to teach and being able to concentrate just on your research is sort of a godsend. And yeah. But also being here in Santa Fe, and actually one of the things that I didn't think about, because I am trained as a Mexicanist and I'm just, you know, just beefing up on my U.S. history since the 1950s, but is to what extent Santa Fe features in a lot of this, and maybe not Castaneda per se, but definitely sort of as the crossroads of a lot of anthropologists, retired anthropologists who live here, how strong some of the sort of new age shamanistic, you know, understandings of spirituality are here, how many people here, much more than I would say elsewhere, a concentration of people who actually have read Castaneda, but also studied Castaneda, some of them known Castaneda even, which is really, really surprising. So I think that aspect, the Santa Fe aspect in and of itself, has been really, really interesting and has really, really taught me a lot.
One thing when people talk about New Age spirituality, which I don't even fully understand what that term means, although you sort of know it when you see it, but I mean, a lot of people are involved in traditions that go back way further than Christianity, mm-hmm. like Buddhism and Hinduism and things like that, and practices of yoga, which are kind of amalgam of all kinds of different traditions and so on. And they do those for good reasons that have to do with, you know, mind and body and sense of spirituality and place and all of that. And then there's some things that seem like total nonsense, and they're all kind of lumped into the mm-hmm. same category. How do you sort that out?
Well, I think you're raising an excellent point, because it is. I think the New Age movement needs a history in and of itself. And I know that people are working on that, but I think that it's really important, because it will teach us a lot about why people are more attracted to certain kind of spiritual beliefs than others. But you're right, a lot is lumped together. And I think to a certain extent, maybe some people would say that is... would function, even to call something New Age by now, is to discredit it, and
yeah,
is to you know, and that's not really where I'm coming from at all. I'm taking this serious as a cultural historian trying to understand a particular cultural phenomenon and why this came into being and how it has changed, because I think it actually has changed a lot. And I think for different people attracted to it, different practitioners coming in at a different times. And of course, like you said, it's an enormous umbrella, right? Because there are people that are very much interested in Buddhist beliefs that sometimes get filed and under New Age as well. As you say, shamanism itself is very, very old.
And then there's some guy who comes into the cafe and says, I can cure all diseases through my vibrational humming.
Yeah.
And you say, thank you very much, have a nice day.
Yeah. Have you experienced that?
Yes. By the way,
it looked like you did. Wow. That's very interesting. Yeah. And I think, you know, that there are, and how it splits off. And I mean, there are a number of books that have been written about more current sort of history or current shamanism, like what is called neo-shamanism, for instance. And that is very interesting as well. And also tensions with indigenous people, because, you know, even here, say in Chaco Canyon, there's some people who want to leave particular belongings that mean something to them in, you know, what was the Great Kiva, right? Or
like make offerings.
Rinconada, I think it's. Yeah, make offerings. And the Park Service actually has a mandate with Pueblo people, from what I understand, to actually take these things out. And file them. So they, I guess, have a whole storage of, you know, some of these objects that have been left behind. So you're right. It is there's a lot going on there, and it needs a lot more scholarship for us to understand. One thing that I do look at is that I try to ascertain, and I think that the corporation here, you know, that Carlos Castaneda founded and left behind when he died. It's really interesting, because it sort of shows a particular trajectory, at least with Castaneda, from this sort of more rebellious, counterculture, leftist beginnings to a particular kind of subjectivity that today we would call neoliberal. Pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. And that has become a really integral part of some of the New Age philosophy as well, right?
Right.
And nobody, but not all.
And nobody sees the contradiction when they're inside of it.
Yeah.
Between, on the one hand, being part of a movement which is collectivist and people helping each other and seeing the roots of oppression. And on the other hand, you can just do it all yourself.
And you should.
And you should.
And I think there's a very interesting political statement there too, right?
Very.
Because if you need to take care of yourself, then it means nobody else really has to. So.
Right. Ahaith Slaus is professor of history at Butler University. She's spent this past academic year at the School for Advanced Research writing about and studying Carlos Castaneda and his influence. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much for having me, Mary Charlotte.
I'd like now to welcome Elise Edwards. She is a professor of anthropology at Butler University, and she too has been at the School for Advanced Research this whole academic year. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
So you've been studying soccer, and in particular, women's soccer in Japan. Is mm-hmm. soccer a relatively recent sport in Japan?
It's pretty new. Those people who are soccer fans, and particularly women's soccer fans, now know that the Japanese women's soccer team, when I say that, their national team is actually one of the best teams in the world now. But this is just something that's happened in the last decade. Unlike our country, where women's soccer, or you know, Northern Europe, where women's soccer has been you know, a really popular sport for young girls, it's only been recently that it's become incredibly popular, and this has to do with the how well their national team has done. Women have been playing soccer in Japan for about since the 1970s, but still the numbers are really low compared to our country, where we have hundreds of thousands of women, and if you include youth in there, we have probably, you know, millions of girl and women soccer players in this country. In Japan, the numbers are probably under 50,000 total in a country that has half the population of our own country.
So how did soccer become such a huge thing so quickly?
Well, and this is one of the things I'm looking at. I got interested in this project in great part because I'm a soccer player. Was a soccer player. I'm now a soccer coach, and I played soccer in Japan before I started this project.
What were you doing playing soccer in Japan?
Avoiding other employment. I was right out of college. I played college soccer at Stanford University and wanted to continue to play. And there really were no opportunities to be a professional other than in Germany a little bit and in Japan, ironically.
So you became a professional soccer player in Japan?
Yeah, yeah. So I had a friend who I had played soccer with in the States who was one of the first Americans to be recruited. But Japanese companies at the time, this is right before the bubble burst in Japan. So this is right around 1990, or late 80s, early 90s. A lot of wealthy corporations were deciding to start women's soccer teams. Now, we can talk about that later, but that has to do with the history, the way that sports are run typically in Japan. But so she was hired. They were hiring players from all over, from China, from Taiwan, from Europe. I played with Norwegian national team players who played on our team in Japan. But anyway, that's how I originally got interested, was because I had gone there to play and was curious about why companies would want to do this. There was no opportunity anywhere else in the world, and this was not a soccer powerhouse of a country, needless to say.
And so you played there, and I suppose you learned Japanese.
Yeah. I fortunately had studied Japanese before. Japan had been a passion for me prior to that. I'd actually done a homestay when I was in college, and my homestay family actually was kind of critical in helping me get back there so I could try out to play for a team. And I also, the fact that I did speak Japanese helped me a little bit because I was the only foreigner on my team who spoke any when I was there.
So what was it like for you, and here you are, an American professional soccer player in Japan in your 20s, first of all, what was the soccer culture there different from what you had known in the U.S.?
Yeah, a lot. And one of the things was, you know, as a foreign player, the foreign players were being brought in. There were only, you know, maximum that were allowed on a team was like five players. They're being brought in on these teams to bring soccer culture, if you will, to bring training habits and knowledge to a lot of very young and inexperienced players and teams. This is kind of ironic now because Japan, if anything, has some of the most talented players in the world. But, you know, this was now 20 years ago. and a lot of the team that I joined that was started by a very wealthy financial company in Tokyo, they basically created a team by recruiting girls who, you know, the goalkeepers, for instance, that I played with had been volleyball players. They had never played soccer before, for instance. Some of the girls had only played soccer for a year or two. So the quality of soccer was not great when we first got there. Needless to say, it's developed by leaps and bounds. When, in comparison to like the U.S. women's soccer program here that was a powerhouse, won the World Cup in 1991 when this happened. Now they lost, you know, they lost the World Cup to Japan in 2011, 20 years later.
Which is really extraordinary. So explain to us what happened.
Well, that's in part what I'm trying to figure out. I mean, my project was inspired by the fact that there was both what was going on in this world of women's soccer that I knew about, but also more broadly, there was what the Japanese called a soccer boom in the early 90s. And they call it a soccer boom. It's actually the Japanese word for soccer boom. And right at the same time that the bubble was bursting in Japan, suddenly soccer was taking off. Some people would say, well, it was just kind of happenstance that this happened, right? Just, odd luck that these things happened almost simultaneously, that soccer took off. And when I'm talking about soccer taking off, I'm talking about a new men's professional league, right? Was on the scene, started in 1993. And soccer, it has not taken, you know, those people who are not familiar with Japanese sports might not know. Those who do know Japan a little bit know that baseball is the number one sport there.
Yeah.
In the 90s, it suddenly looked like soccer was going to, you know, usurp baseball for the number one position. Suddenly, like all of a sudden, people were huge fans and buying up products, and because they were doing a really good job of marketing this league. So one thing was doing really well, all while, you know, soccer was doing really well, while the rest of the economy was just faltering. So I thought that was curious. And soccer became kind of the sport of the 90s at this really critical juncture in Japanese post-war history, when a country that had always had economic growth, it had never had a year without economic growth, it had a booming, you know, double-digit growth all through the 60s and then even into the 70s, and again had, you know, a huge economy in the 80s. You probably remember this. Everyone was talking about, you know, Japan was going to buy the world. They were buying, you know, the Empire State Building. They were buying Pebble Beach and this kind of thing. Suddenly this country hits a recession that our country had hit a bit earlier and was having discussions about why this was happening and what needed to change to get them back on track. They haven't gotten back on track, unfortunately. Now they're hitting, you know, now the third decade of a really trying economic times. And our country now looks, our government looks and says, their government's making mistakes we don't want to make in terms of economic policy and so on. But for me, the fact that soccer was such a, as an anthropologist of sport, you know, one of my interests is the way that sport both reflects the time, but is also a space where citizens discuss kind of new ideals and new ideas about how to be in the world, for instance. So, you know, one of the arguments I make in my work is that, you know, baseball was the sport that was seen as being kind of representative of Japanese national culture. You know, and Japanese baseball players were representative of the best qualities of a Japanese man, per se. And there were all these connections made between the best qualities, why Japanese businesses were so powerful, and, you know, the qualities of their baseball players, for instance. And we get into the 90s, and suddenly people say, oh, maybe there's this new idea of Japan, and they attach it to soccer.
Ah, right? So as a response, okay, baseball's not working to make us number one, let's try something else?
Well, in some ways, I mean, the interesting thing was when soccer kind of emerged on the scene, some people, the image it had was, it was kind of the bad boy sport. You know, guys were wearing earrings and long hair and doing all the things baseball players never did. They had kind of very military-style haircuts and very clean cut. And so the people who denounced the sport would just say, well, this is why Japan's in a bad place. Like, look at these guys, right? Other people said, no, look, because they're actually creative and they're new and they even... in some ways entrepreneurial, they're global because they play a global sport rather than this domestic based sport of baseball, and they have all these qualities that are going to have to be the qualities of 21st century Japanese workers you know, working in a new economy and in a more globalized. This is at the same time that a lot of deregulation was happening in Japan, so a lot of companies were becoming much more globalized. The financial sector was becoming much more globalized.
And the way soccer is played, like all these people running around the field, is somehow a metaphor for that?
This is what journalists and coaches, so those who wanted to promote the sport, those who love the sport, these are the arguments they made. And I'm not saying, having studied sport as long as I have, any sport can be said to be representative of 100 different things.
Right. But meanwhile, let's talk about women, because, I mean, when you talk about changing culture, certainly the changing role of women in every society around the world practically right now, including the United States, including right. everywhere. But, I mean, in Japan, there were presumably traditional cultural roles for Japanese females that were at odds with the Japanese female soccer star.
Yeah, for sure. One of the things that also brought me to this project was my interest in who the young women were who decided to play. There weren't that many of them, needless to say. And there weren't a lot of... It was difficult to find a place to play as a young woman in Japan. So who were these young women who were doing this? And I found a lot of them said things, I mean, related to your question, this is not traditional. This is a space outside of kind of, well, traditional girl sports, first of all, which are softball and volleyball, in Japan. I think for some of them, they saw it as an escape from their families, to be honest. These were professional teams where they were living somewhere else at a relatively young age, which is unusual in Japan. But in terms of the kind of gender that one could say was either developed and also kind of, you know, celebrated by a lot of these young soccer players, they got to be in their bodies and play a sport that was very untraditional. A lot of them would cut their hair like their favorite male soccer star, you know, soccer stars that they like so much. And this did cause tensions. The companies that owned the teams would promote the teams as being extremely feminine, you often using like anime images that we're familiar with, these like very hyper feminine creatures. So you'd have, you know, great team and company or team brochures or league brochures that have kind of hypersexualized images, anime or comic images on the front. And then, you know, open up the brochure and you'd look at the pictures of the team members and they all had short haircuts.
I thought you said their male counterparts all had long flowing hair.
Well, some of them wear long hair and they could do that too, but you know, in a kind of a masculine guise where they would wear, you know, or they, you know, dye their hair, which was also very common and is not considered either traditional or properly feminine.
So let's talk for a moment about how these soccer teams are run. They're all corporate?
So in Japan, they have a tradition of corporate sports that is a little different than the way we think about professional sports. The system is dying, unfortunately, but over the 20th century, a lot of companies would sponsor teams to both provide workers with something to do on the side, to attract good workers, right? To give themselves a name and identity within their industry. So this was not as much about market. The way we think about professional sports is, well, they're run as franchises to make money, obviously through ticket sales and sales of merchandise and so on. But these teams were not. They were supposed to promote their companies to some degree, but they weren't marketed heavily. Instead, you know, to give you an example, most sports would be within a particular industry. So, for instance, the steel industry was really. It was really common within the steel industry in Japan to sponsor basketball teams. So most steel companies had a basketball team. Having the best basketball team within the steel industry was an important thing. You were often competing for similar workers. So the workers wanted to work for the company, you know, maybe the same work wherever they went. The team that had the best, you know, the company that had the best team. Electronics were really into rugby. So like Seiko and these companies, we think about that. And soccer went on to, you know, was the most recent sport. But they had this tradition. So just to tell you how kind of important this is for Japanese sports, and we have, in this country, we have high school and college sports where we recruit, where we develop Olympic athletes often, right? In Japan, In the 1964 Olympics, for instance, their women's volleyball team won the gold medal, surprisingly, over the Soviets. And it was, Japan was both thrilled to be hosting that Olympics, but to have this win was huge, and that team has been celebrated ever since. That team, all of the players except for one, all came from one textile company.
Oh my goodness.
And they all worked as textile, industrial textile workers, and they typically worked all day and then trained well into the night. And their coach was famous for being just driving them so hard and working them so hard, and became quite famous for doing this. But yeah, they really were workers. They weren't professional athletes by any means. They were, we call them either industry sports or corporate sports in Japan.
And this system is still going strong.
It's not. With the financial troubles that Japan has seen in the last 20 years, the system has actually been in quite a bit of crisis. In the league that I have been, the Women's Soccer League, for instance, I've been studying, a lot of the financing was pulled from a lot of teams right around the year 2000. So you might ask, well, then how did they get so much better, a decade later?
Yeah.
Sponsorships occurred in other ways, but actually women's soccer isn't sponsored. The players aren't sponsored as well as they were in the past. The organization of training the national team has improved. The knowledge, the coaching knowledge and so on, development, the youth development programs have improved. But the corporate support that was there, even 10 years ago, it's starting to improve a little bit, but
it went down with the economy.
Yeah, it did, and all other sports were hurt too. So
now, did the Japanese government, or does the Japanese government support soccer?
The Japanese government and the Japan Football Association are quite tightly connected, and I don't know all the ways, but obviously they hosted the World Cup, for instance, in 2002, and this is one of the reasons why soccer took off in the 90s. Japan wanted the World Cup. They were the first. They ended up co-hosting with South Korea, but they and South Korea, they were the first Asian, they were the first non-European or Latin American or North American hosts ever.
Right.
So that project was very much a Japanese government and JFA project. The government does not... I mean, to some degree, they're still involved in these kinds of things I'm interested in, the way that sport gets used kind of in connection with government policy to develop. Well, one of the things that's going on right now is because of economic problems, they're really working on trying to develop what they call economic regionalism in Japan, right, to boost local areas, the economies in local areas, figure out new ways to boost economies in local areas. So one of the things the Japan Football Association has been pushing is the development of what they call hometown teams, right? So they have been placing teams in very small or encouraging very small kind of depressed rural areas that may have a hot spring, for instance, right? Or may have some other kinds of tourist types attractions to support a team. And the goal is to create a sense of both local identity, to get people to stay in their communities, to try to invest and encourage kind of tourist traffic through these places. It's been working in some places, ironically, but that is a project that is clearly very connected to government-led initiatives to try to promote economic growth in these difficult times.
Getting back to the whole question of women's traditional roles, and then you have these soccer players. We have kind of, I don't know if they're cliches or probably there's some truth to them, ideas about collectivist cultures versus individualist cultures in Japan. Very much, you work for a company your whole life and you're part of the nation and you're part of the company and it's a collectivist identity. And then you have this other influence, which is the star, the individual.
Right.
How does this
Well, it's great that you bring up this question, because one of the primary shifts, I would argue, in terms of ideas of identity being connected to sport, is that soccer is very much about individuality, at least in the way that it's promoted in Japan. I'm not saying that's true everywhere.
Which is weird, since it's such a group sport.
It is, and if anything, like countries like Germany that are perennial powerhouses, right, their strength is the fact that they are they're almost machine-like, right, in the way that they're so synchronized and they work together and, if anything, lose their individuality in their connected team nature, right? And that's their strength. This gets at how also national stereotypes get attached to sports. So, for instance, Brazilians, apparently, they're often very strong, and some years they do better than others, but they're typically a very strong team. But their strength is supposedly that they have these, individual kind of creative actors who are the, if they would be Brazilian dancers if they weren't soccer players, kind of thing. And in Japan, and this is where it gets connected to economics, in my opinion, we get into the 90s, the economy falters, the sport takes off. Needless to say, there are individualistic personalities on these teams, very flamboyant characters. But this is the way the sport also gets promoted. This is also an economy like our own, with kind of, the faltering welfare state and the, and they had a much stronger welfare program than we had in this country. But and the decline of what had been, almost 100% employment, and companies that were hiring and keeping were, they had this. To some degree, it's a myth, but for most white-collar workers, they could enter a company in the past in Japan and plan to work there for their life, right? And now the country looks a lot like our own, where most young people have to expect to have 3, 4, 5 careers over the course of their lifetime. So you have to be more individualistic. You have to be more entrepreneurial. And the qualities that they say are kind of that are idealized in soccer players are also these qualities that and this is part of my argument, is the sport, both how young people are trained in this sport and the kind of qualities they're told to have, which is they're supposed to be able to self-monitor themselves, they're supposed to be really creative, they're supposed to be have their own ideas, they're supposed to have initiative, right? Whereas the old ideal of the baseball player in the old Japanese economy was you were supposed to listen to your manager. You were supposed to be a good team player. You were supposed to stand at the plate and look at what the manager told was, whether you're going to hit or bunt or try to steal, whatever you were doing, what someone else was telling you to do, and you were supposed to be a good team player, Whereas the soccer players, and this, I'm not coming up with this. This is actually what journalists write about. This is what coaches write about. The best players are the ones who, stand with a soccer ball. The coach is too far away for them to hear their voice, and they have 10 other team members of their team members, 11 other players on the other team, all arranged in constantly shifting and changing formations around them, and they have to decide what to do with the ball, and there's multiple options, right? And that's going to require creativity, initiative, entrepreneurial spirit, and
so
on.
A metaphor for the current economy.
Exactly.
Very, very interesting. Elise Edwards is professor of anthropology at Butler University, and she has been at the School for Advanced Research studying this whole subject during this whole academic year. Mm-hmm. It's just great to have you on the Radio Cafe. Thank you so much for being with us.
No problem. It's been enjoyable. I always like talking about soccer.